Okay, as you can tell from the TBA that was in the program, I was having trouble deciding what to talk about. I was hoping, since this is a string cosmology conference, that I'd have some Brain World project finished that I could talk about, but that didn't happen. So I'm continuing to eternally talk about eternal inflation. I realized that would be fun to talk about eternal inflation at a string cosmology conference. I've been talking about it a lot at conferences that are more astrophysically oriented. And the astrophysicist always asked me, well, can you see these other universes that you're talking about? And I have to say no. And they say, well, no. So talking to string theorists is better, because I mean, string theorists have a long tradition of being interested in problems that have no observable consequences. So we can understand each other well. And furthermore, it really does turn out that eternal inflation really is very close to the heart of the interface, it seems, actually, between what particle physicists are interested in and string theorists and cosmologists. So here goes. This is an outline of what I want to talk about in a little bit more detail. I can never resist an opportunity for praising the wonders of how well inflation is doing, so I'm going to start by doing that. But I'll try to do it quickly. And then we'll get on to eternal inflation, and I want to first discuss the mechanisms that make inflation eternal, and I'll argue that essentially any kind of successful inflation leads to eternal inflation. Then I'll talk about the implications of it, which is where it's so much more fun to talk to string theorists than to astrophysicists. And then I want to talk about ambiguities that exist in our picture of eternal inflation. I don't think we really know how one is supposed to calculate probabilities in an eternally inflating multiverse. And then I'll also talk, sort of a grab bag of topics, I have to admit. Then we'll also discuss a singularity theorem associated with the question of, once you decide inflation is eternal into the future, it's natural to ask, is it eternal also into the past? And there's a theorem which I was involved in proving with Alex Olenkin and Arvin Borda, which I think with a few reasonable provisos shows that inflation cannot be eternal into the past, only into the future. So when I say eternal inflation, I could perhaps call it semi-eternal inflation or future eternal inflation. I'm really only discussing the possibility that inflation is eternal into the future. Okay, so here's my promised slide about the successes of inflation. There are really a number of features that our universe seems to have that we don't know how to explain except by assuming that it underwent a period of inflation. First is the mere fact that the universe is big, about 10 to the 90th particles. And again, some people I talk to say, well, of course it's big, it's the universe. But again, us theorists understand that it's not so obvious that the universe has to be big. But inflation has a natural way of making it big by having exponential expansion. Inflation basically reduces the problem of how to get 10 to the 90 particles to the problem of how to get 60 e-folds of inflation. And 60 is a much more tame number than 10 to the 90. The Hubble expansion itself is again something that people often take for granted. But inflation provides an answer of where it came from, what it was that propelled the universe into this period of expansion, which without inflation we don't really have any explanation for. Getting down to things that are a bit more quantitative, there's the famous homogeneity and isotropy problems. The observed universe is incredibly homogeneous and isotropic on large scales. One can imagine that the universe perhaps started out inhomogeneous, and you can ask, was there time for it to become homogeneous soon enough for us to see what we see in the cosmic background radiation? And as many of you probably know, in the context of conventional cosmology, without inflation, you would need to transmit energy and information at about 100 times the speed of light to be able to homogenize the universe in time to make the cosmic background look so homogeneous. So in the context of conventional cosmology, the only way to arrange for the universe to look homogeneous is to start it that way by fiat. While with inflation, you can start it very lumpy. You can start it almost any way at all, and inflation will smooth it out because of the smoothing power associated with the exponential expansion. A similar problem is the flatness problem. If we extrapolate back to 1 second after the Big Bang and ask how close did omega have to be to 1 at that time, you get numbers like it had to be equal to 1 to 15 decimal places. And in conventional cosmology, there's no reason to prefer omega equals 1. Conventional cosmology is equally logical for any initial value of omega. It just has to have started out extraordinarily close to 1 to match the observed universe. So in conventional cosmology, it's an open question of how did omega get to be so close to 1. With inflation, the inflation takes care of that for you. During the inflationary period, omega is driven towards 1, and it's driven towards 1 amazingly rapidly. So a very short period of inflation can take care of the possibility that omega may have started out before inflation as being 2, a tenth, 10 to the 5, 10 to the minus 5. Whatever number you pick for omega, if you have enough inflation, and it doesn't take that much, it will drive omega to 1. There's also the question of magnetic monopoles. If one believes in something like grand unified theories, then magnetic monopoles should exist as part of the particle spectrum. And in the context of grand unified theories, one could estimate how many of them would have been produced in the early universe, and it always turns out to be far too many. Inflation gets rid of them because inflation could just dilute them away after they form or dilute them as they're forming. Either way, that works fine. And finally, the success that has been getting better and better in year, month by month almost, is the prediction that inflationary models make for the density perturbations in the universe, which arise as quantum fluctuations of a scalar field as it rolls down a hill, ending inflation. And the prediction is that we should have nearly scale invariant adiabatic Gaussian density perturbations. And it really seems that the universe is doing exactly that, just like the doctor ordered. The best, most recent observation is the WMAP experiment, the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe. There's Dave Wilkinson up in the right-hand corner. He's certainly one of the real founders of microwave research and the driving force behind microwave background research for, I guess, 40 years or something like that. And was very important in setting off the WMAP project. This is a picture of WMAP in orbit, and this is a diagram of the orbit. As many of you probably know, the satellite hovers around a point called L2, one of the Lagrange points, which means that there's always a line between the Sun, the Earth, and WMAP. WMAP goes around the Earth with the Sun, around the Earth, around, that's right. I knew I should have slept last night instead of, okay. Okay, WMAP goes around the Sun with the Earth, right? I got it right that time? Okay. There's always on a line between the Sun, the Earth, and the satellite, which is the perfect place for doing astronomy because you can look out and the three major obstacles, the Sun, the Earth, and the Moon, are always behind it. So it has a completely unobstructed view of space at all times. There are a number of astronomical missions planned for L2, but WMAP was in fact the first. Finally, the wonderful data. This is the power spectrum shown on top and plotted against a thin red line, which is the theoretical prediction. The prediction depends on maybe 6 or slightly more parameters, depending on what you count as a free parameter. But in fact, almost all of those are strongly constrained, either by inflation itself or by other astronomical measurements. So there's really very little freedom in constructing that curve. And it fits the data absolutely beautifully. The one thing that's really open, I should mention, is the overall amplitude. You could multiply this by a constant, and the only thing that fixes that constant, really, is the fit to this data. But the other parameters are all rather highly constrained, and everything just fits together beautifully. On the bottom panel, we have a graph of the correlation between the E-type polarization and the temperature modes. And again, there's a very good fit between the theoretical predictions and the measured points. It's, I think, just astounding. Okay. Having marveled about that for a little while, I'll go back to my outline here. Next, I'm supposed to start talking about eternal inflation. And first, I'm going to describe the mechanisms that cause inflation to be eternal. So my claim is that essentially all known inflationary models are eternal, which means that once inflation starts, it never stops. And I'm going to describe it in terms of sort of two chapters. First, I'll describe it in terms of what's often called small field inflation. It's the descendant of what historically was called new inflation, where a scalar field begins perched on top of a hill. I'm going to take the liberty of calling that state a false vacuum, even though historically a false vacuum was always a local minimum. This state has almost the same properties as long as the hill is wide enough. When the scalar field perches on top, the energy density of the state is effectively fixed, and that's what drives the inflation itself. Eventually, the scalar field will roll down the hill, so this false vacuum is a metastable state. But the metastability is similar to other metastable states that we know about in physics. They decay exponentially. And in this case, to the extent that you can model this as an upside-down quadratic, it becomes an exactly soluble problem. And you find that there's always a tail of the wave function that survives, indicating that the scalar field is still at the top of the hill. And that tail of the wave function falls off exponentially with time, with a time constant that's controlled by the curvature of the potential at the top, essentially the negative mass squared of the inflaton field. Now, in any successful model, that negative mass squared is small compared to the Hubble constant. So even though it's decaying, the important point is that the rate of inflation is much, much greater than the rate of decay. So if you sat at any one point, you would very rapidly see the scalar field falling down with high probability. But if you step back and look at the whole space-time, the volume of space where the scalar field is at the top of the hill in the false vacuum state is actually increasing with time exponentially, not decreasing at all. And the first model of this type was constructed by Paul Steinhardt, and in the same year, but slightly later, Alex Vilenkin wrote a paper indicating how generic this is. That essentially happens in any version of new inflation. If one tries to visualize what's going on in the space-time, I think a real picture would be, well, I guess Alex, Andre has some real pictures of spikes sticking up. This is much more schematic, but I think may still give you it'll give you a complementary point of view about what's going on. The idea is that if you have a region of false vacuum and you wait a little bit, pieces of it will decay and become an ordinary universe, but other pieces will remain in the false vacuum. And in this picture, you're supposed to imagine that at each step, the length scale increases by a factor of 3. This is just sort of a numerical example, which means that this length is exactly the same as that length was. So after one time interval, you have a universe and two regions of false vacuum, each of which were as big as what you started with. And then this just iterates ad infinitum, producing what clearly is approaching a fractal structure for space-time as a whole. Now, this picture is, of course, highly schematic. The real universe is, of course, three-dimensional at least, and certainly not one-dimensional. And furthermore, the decay of the false vacuum is really a random process. Well, I've sketched it as a completely systematic process. So the real picture will look much more complicated than this, but we'll have the same fractal structure. What is a clear prediction of this is that the universe does acquire a fractal structure on length scales that are all too large for us to directly observe. And the key point is that if inflation happens once, an infinite number of universes are in fact produced, not just one. So it's a real bargain. Okay, now the other important type of inflation is sometimes called chaotic inflation or large field inflation. It's where a scalar field starts high up on a hill and rolls down, with the inflation occurring as it rolls down. And it was Andre Lind who invented this model and showed that it, in fact, is also eternal. The eternal nature of this is much less obvious, but I think it's still valid. The important point is that quantum fluctuations play a very conspicuous role in these kinds of space-times. Quantum fluctuations are, of course, always present, we know, on very small length scales. The thing about inflation is that it's constantly stretching these small length scales to become macroscopic. So one sees very macroscopic effects of quantum fluctuations in inflationary models. And this eternal inflation is an example of that. We have a scalar field rolling down the hill, and we're going to model it quantitatively by asking what happens during one Hubble time, one interval delta t of magnitude h inverse. And we're going to look at the average value of the field in a region of Hubble size, h inverse. The idea is to make everything Hubble scale, and then you can estimate everything. It's just some power of h. So during this time period, this average value of the field will undergo classical evolution and also a quantum jump. And the quantum jump will have a root mean square value of about h over 2 pi. And of course, you know it's going to be of order h because everything's of order h in the way we set things up here. So one should think of this quantum increment as being superimposed on top of the classical motion. And you could think of it as having a Gaussian probability distribution in the free field approximation. So as the scalar field rolls down the hill, these quantum fluctuations are equally likely to push it up or down. So you might think the net effect would be zero, but that's not the way it works. The key thing to remember again is the expansion. The expansion is the crucial thing. So during this interval of one Hubble time, the entire volume is going to increase by a factor of e cubed, which is about equal to 20. And since communication doesn't really happen on length scales greater than a Hubble length, it means that this one region of space is going to be splitting up into 20 independent regions of space during the time that we're watching it. That means that if we could arrange, if we pick some value of the field, which I'll call phi sub zero, if we could arrange for the probability of phi jumping up to be just bigger than 1/20, it doesn't have to jump up on average. If the probability of it jumping up is just bigger than 1/20, then since we're producing 20 regions, we're going to, on average, have just as much space where the field is high at the end of the time period as we did before. And if you exceed 1/20, then you're doing better. You're increasing the volume. So to be a little bit more quantitative, looking up, doing a little calculation about Gaussian distributions, you find that the probability of going up exceeds 1/20 if h over 2 pi exceeds 0.61 times the classical evolution. And the classical evolution is the time derivative of the classical equation times the amount of time, which is h inverse. So this is the inequality, which tells you when you've hit the point of eternal inflation. And by doing a little bit of arithmetic on that, you can write it in this form. And the key thing, for those of you who know about calculations of density perturbations in inflationary models, is that h squared over the time derivative of the classical solution is exactly the estimate of delta rho over rho for scalar density perturbations. So that makes a lot of sense. It says that eternal inflation sets in at precisely the point where the scalar density perturbations are of order 1. And that makes sense, obviously, because if you have eternal inflation, it means that inflation is going on some places, has ended in other places. So on those very long length scales, delta rho over rho is of order 1. And it's calculated really in a way that's completely analogous to the density perturbations, which we also calculate and measure. So there's a certain amount of measurement associated with this eternal inflation. It really is the long wavelength tail of the density perturbations that we directly observe. Raphael? Well, I was going to admit on the next transparency that there are some ambiguities here, but I would argue that you're only at the edge of that region. Remember, you don't need to be going up half the time and down half the time in a complete random walk. In fact, you've arranged things so you go up 1/20 of the time and go down 19/20 of the time. So you are in the regime where there still is, on average, a slow roll downward. So I can't promise you that what you're saying is irrelevant, but I don't think it's irrelevant. Andre?
Yeah. Just locally, when you look at the thing locally at the scale of h minus 1, which is what many string theorists like to do and many models don't. Okay? So locally, you indeed change all the time, your local time, because you are jumping up and jumping down. If you take, however, the average way how the scale of field behaves, the scale of field in average, every given point in average, still continues going down. So there is one clock for the whole universe, and you do not have any freedom rotating while your global coordinate system, so that to avoid this rolling down on the field. And this field is global clock. It remains preserved despite local jumps of the field.
So my guess is the topic will come up in the question, and you should save it for the session.
Yeah. I was just going to say the same thing. I think we better go on here, or this one can go on forever, I know. Okay, finally on this transparency, I just have a particular example. If you consider the lambda phi to the fourth theory, it reaches the point of eternal inflation when phi is bigger than 0.75 times lambda to the minus sixth M Planck. Lambda is a small number, so this is bigger than M Planck. But if you look at the energy density, that ends up being a positive power times lambda times M Planck to the fourth. So the energy density could be sub-Planckian, but the value of the field is super-Planckian, and that's typically what one finds. Okay, now I was going to, as I promised when Raphael asked the question, I was going to admit that there are some shortcomings here as far as actual rigor. First of all, in these calculations, once phi reaches the point where it starts to go up, it continues to go up. At least the volumes which phi becomes very high become larger and larger until it gets to be the order of Planck scale itself, and even in terms of energy. At that point, you can argue that the gradient terms become large and inflation tends to turn off, but nonetheless, you've gotten yourself well into the Planck regime before you can even say that. So you're certainly delving into regions that we don't understand. I also do admit here, which is I think what part of Raphael's point, that we don't really have a fully quantum mechanical description of all this. It's a rather semi-classical, one patch at a time, not really looking at the whole space-time globally. So I'm pretty well convinced by the argument, but nonetheless there are shortcomings in it. However, I would urge anyone who is fixating on these shortcomings to consider the new inflation case, the small field inflation case, because there I think the argument is really essentially unassailable. If you're rolling off the top of a hill, classically you would inflate forever. Classically, it's obviously eternal. The only question is, can quantum mechanics prevent it from being eternal? And you calculate quantum mechanically and you discover that you fall off the hill exponentially and it's not fast enough to prevent it from becoming eternal.
The formula isn't there, it's identical. And there also the boundary of self-reproduction goes along the boundary vector of rho equal to 1. Exactly.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Well, I disagree. One's off in the Planck regime and the other could be at an arbitrarily low energy. So I consider one more solid than the other. But I consider this to be true. I just recognize that there are people who doubt it and I don't regard them as being stupid. Some of them are my friends even. Okay, so that's all I want to say about mechanisms. Now I want to talk about implications. I want to list four of them. First two are on this slide. First of all, it would mean, I believe, that hypotheses about the ultimate initial conditions of the universe would still be very interesting because we'd like to know where the universe came from. So I think they'd definitely be interesting. But nonetheless, I think this picture really divorces those theories from any kind of observation. Because this eternally inflating tree would go on arbitrarily long, we would be living somewhere at some time that's something like the geometric mean between 1 and infinity, and that's pretty high. So we'd be living sometime very far off down this tree, and presumably the tree would approach some kind of a steady state, and what we'd be seeing would be the properties of that steady state network, we would not be at all sensitive to whatever it was that actually started the whole process of eternal inflation in the first place. Second and related point, this means that the plausibility of inflation beginning becomes almost irrelevant because inflation only needs to begin once in all of eternity. So as long as the probability is non-zero, I think it really doesn't matter how large it is. I think you really ask the question, how could inflation possibly not begin if you're talking about it not beginning at any time in all of eternity? It also has relevance if you're trying to compare one form of inflation with another. In the past, some people have argued that new type inflation or small field inflation is less likely than chaotic inflation because the initial conditions have to be more finely tuned. I think that's completely irrelevant if it's going to be eternal. Okay, getting on to things that make more contact with the stringy questions. It's a feature of this eternally inflating system that the spatial volume grows exponentially, incredibly quickly, and without bound. And that leads to questions about what kind of a theory we're going to use to describe this system as a quantum system, and in particular, what can one say about the number of degrees of freedom? Now, I don't know any answers here, but I've just tried to list possibilities for the sake of provoking discussion. So let me indicate sort of what I think the questions are and what are some possible answers. First of all, one has to ask, is the number of degrees of freedom that describes the universe finite or infinite? I don't know, but I find it very hard to imagine that a finite number of degrees of freedom can possibly describe an ever-enlarging multiverse that's going to grow without bound. So as far as I can see, these two pictures are only consistent if one is willing to admit an infinite number of degrees of freedom into one's underlying quantum theory that's going to describe the multiverse. Now, if the number of degrees of freedom is infinite, it runs into conflicts with this causal patch picture of the universe. And there are certainly several ways, I believe, that are known that to get around any controversy there. If it turns out that all states which have positive cosmological constant are unstable, then you never really get an ultimate De Sitter space, and I think this problem goes away. Then I think the string theorists are willing to tolerate an infinite number of degrees of freedom. It was also pointed out recently in a paper by Banks and Fischler that if you had such an eternally inflating space-time, it's not completely obvious that it would have to be asymptotically De Sitter. And if it was not asymptotically De Sitter, that would also get around problems of requiring a finite number of degrees of freedom. Now, if the number is infinite, which is what I am suspecting, then there's still subtle questions here. Where are all these infinite number of degrees of freedom hidden when the universe is very, very small? One possibility is that the degrees of freedom are actually created as the multiverse expands. Another possibility that I can imagine, which to me sounds more plausible, is that the universe begins with an infinite number of degrees of freedom already present, as it would if you described it by a field theory, where all the high energy modes are there as possible excitations. But since it's small, and most of these are then very high energy excitations, you expect that most of them are frozen in the sense that there's just not enough energy around to excite them. So the number of degrees of freedom that are excited in the early universe is presumably finite. But as the multiverse enlarges, more and more degrees of freedom become unfrozen as the length scales go up, and therefore the energy scales of each of these modes come down. Another alternative I have to admit is that conceivably string theory might eventually convince people that the number of degrees of freedom has to be finite and that maybe eternal inflation really can't happen. But personally, I find it a little hard to believe that string theory can forbid a process which seems to be such a natural consequence of ordinary quantum field theory and general relativity occurring in the new inflation case, even at energy scales that are very low compared to the Planck scale. So I strongly suspect that eternal inflation is real and that one of these other options is what happens. Okay, next, there's the question of how string theory picks out the vacuum-like state in which we expect to find ourselves, the famous question about the A word. Now here I'm going to admit my prejudices. Although I'm a big, big fan of eternal inflation, I've never been a big fan of the anthropic principle, although I'm told that conversions are possible. hasn't happened yet in this case. I still regard the anthropic principle very much as the explanation of last resort, and I don't think we should give into it until we're sure that there's no better explanation for the world around us. And I'm sure if we wait long enough, David Gross will find it for us, and we'll be okay. I want to advertise here that there's at least a possibility that inflation could play a role in solving that problem, that is, avoiding relying completely on the anthropic principle. And the idea is that even if there are some humongous number of vacuum-like states in string theory, it could turn out that inflation produces overwhelmingly more of one type than the others. And the way that would work is that inflation clearly favors the states that inflate the fastest. Now, I'm going to talk in a few minutes about the fact that we don't really know how to calculate probabilities in this eternally inflating universe. But still, I would assert that it's a plausible hypothesis that the state or states that exponentially expand the fastest will, in the end, dominate this multiverse. Now, it might be one state or it might be several states. It would only take a small difference, I believe, to make a big difference in the probabilities. Since this eternal inflation goes on for an infinite amount of time, if one process wins by an infinitesimally small difference in rate compared to another process, I think the process that's faster will still win by an infinite amount in volume. Nonetheless, when one state exponentially expands, it drags a lot of other states with it. All states that are in the decay chain of this fastest expanding state will, in fact, exponentially expand at the same rate. This will be some fixed rate at which the highest energy state will be decaying into the others. So there'll still be a very complicated chain, which one would have to sort through, and the idea would be that we would be most likely to find somewhere on this decay chain. Now, it could be that the highest, fastest exponentially expanding state just decays into everything, and then we're out of luck. But it is nonetheless, I think, at least possible that the decay chain is limited, and that it could occupy much less, a very small fraction of the full landscape of string theory, in which case it could be it could help a great deal in giving the theory predictive power. Now, I do have to admit that at present time, this idea is entirely wishful thinking, nothing else. But we are certainly at the earliest stages of understanding the nature of this landscape of string theory vacua, so probably it's a reasonable time to make idle speculations. Okay, that ends what I wanted to say about implications. The next topic I want to talk about was the ambiguities in calculating these probabilities, which I think is an important shortcoming of our present understanding. And I really have no idea what to do about this, so if anybody has any suggestions, please let us know. The key point is that since we're going to be producing literally an infinite number of universes, you can start out by saying that anything that can happen will happen, period. And that means that the question of what can happen isn't too interesting. One wants to know what is likely to happen. And that means one wants to be able to calculate probabilities. But since the space-time is infinite, if you ask what fraction of it has any particular property, the answer is infinity divided by infinity, which doesn't help you any. So you want to find some way of getting answers. The usual approach when you deal with infinite systems is to take a piece of it, to regularize it by cutting off a piece. So you could imagine doing that here. You could regulate it in some way to choose a finite space-time volume and then try to let the cutoff go away. But the problem is that when you do that, you find that it actually ends up depending very strongly on the way that you've chosen your cutoff. And that creates a serious ambiguity. Furthermore, depending on how you choose the cutoff, you can even get very weird results. And just to show you how important the problem is, I'm going to discuss one particular way of doing the cutoff, which leads to something that I call the youngness paradox. And this arises if you imagine applying a cutoff at fixed time in some previously defined coordinate system. I like to think of this in terms of a synchronous coordinate system, one where time is measured by proper time of a set of observers. So suppose we let the system evolve up to some finite, up to some time as measured by some set of observers and cut it off there and ask what are the probabilities up to that time. The key thing that becomes peculiar about it is that the rate of production of these, I call them pocket universes, is growing exponentially with time, with a time constant that could be something like 10 to the minus 37 seconds, incredibly fast. And what that means is that whenever you cut off at a fixed time, most of the universes that are near your cut are universes that just formed, not a second ago, but something on the order of 10 to the minus 37 seconds ago. And furthermore, if you look back in your past, for every pocket universe that has some arbitrarily chosen age t, there are about e to the 10 to the 37 universes that are 1 second younger. And the square of that number, they are 2 second younger, and so on. A tremendous premium on youngness. The probability distribution of these bubble universes is incredibly youth-dominated. Now, what's the problem with that? The problem with that is if you ask yourself any question that involves making historical inferences, questions of the type, how did we get here? What you find is that when you think about different scenarios for how we got here, with this distribution of universes, it means that you have an a priori advantage of a factor of e to the 10 to the 37 if somebody offers you a scenario that can get us here 1 second faster. And if somebody can offer a scenario that gets us here 2 seconds faster, it's the square of that, and so on. And that tremendously distorts things. This problem, I think, was first mentioned. I should point out that the first up to here is what you already read. The new part is just here. I believe this problem was first mentioned in a paper by Linde and Majlumian in 1994, which had the precious title, Do We Live in the Center of the World?, which I think is very memorable. What they're talking about is a prediction that comes out of this kind of reasoning, which is that we should be living in a spherical pocket in the universe of low density, surrounded by regions of much higher density. And that's what you get because of the fact that this tilting of the probability distribution means that everything is, in fact, much younger than what you thought it looked like. It's much more probable that it got here by some freak sequence of events than that it got here by the usual evolution process that you had in the back of your mind in the first place. So it would mean that the universe is really much younger than we think. Our part of the universe looks old because it got there by random jumps, but if you look far away, it should look younger and therefore denser, hotter, and we're living in a pocket. Now, there are other ways of defining probabilities in this space. In particular, Alex Valenkin and a set of collaborators, a number of different papers, have devised ways of defining probabilities that are based on essentially picking out bubble universes and looking at probabilities within bubble universes rather than comparing them across an equal time slice. And then you can avoid things like this youngness paradox. But it's essentially a prescription. To me, the key problem is that we really don't have any fundamental principle to tell us what's the right way to calculate probabilities in these spacetimes. And I think that's an important gap. Okay, so next on my list and last, I want to discuss this initial singularity theorem, the question of can our universe be eternal into the past? And the theorem that I want to discuss was written in a paper by Arvind Borda, Alex Valenkin, and me. And it's a very simple theorem, really. The key idea is that what we want to do is to follow a geodesic observer through our universe and see what she sees. Now, if our universe is expanding, we know that an object moving along a geodesic through an expanding universe will redshift, just like photons redshift. In this case, redshift means slow down. But that also means that if you follow an observer backwards in time, she'll be speeding up. And in fact, what the calculation shows is that in a finite amount of time, she reaches the speed of light, and then you just can't continue it any further. Now, important to this, and what makes it so pretty, is that the redshift turns out to be a purely kinematical effect. It does not depend at all on the dynamical equations of general relativity, and that makes this result completely independent of any energy conditions, which are preconditions for the other theorems that have been shown in the past for this type of a question. The energy conditions are all somewhat suspect in the cosmological context because quantum fluctuations can violate any of them. But this proof, as I'm saying, is pure kinematics. The way to see the kinematic relationship between the redshift and measurements of the Hubble constant is to imagine a simple one-dimensional non-relativistic model. So since things are moving in one dimension, we'll call the one dimension a road, and we'll call the objects moving in that one dimension cars. So we have a universe of cars moving down the road, and there's a geodesic observer watching them. We can go to the rest frame of the geodesic observer. So geodesic observer is sitting at the side of the road, cars are going by, and the geodesic observer is measuring the velocity of each car as it goes by. Now, we'll assume that our universe is expanding for the sake of discussion, and suppose the first car goes by at 70 kilometers per hour. What does that say about the second car? Well, it's certainly not going to be 80 kilometers per hour, because if it was, they'd be getting closer, and that means the sea of cars is not expanding. So I think you can see from that that the rate at which the cars are separating from each other is exactly the rate at which their velocity is changing relative to the observer on the side of the road. Now, what's a little surprising is that that argument, in fact, generalizes to three dimensions, even if you don't assume that things are collinear, and it generalizes to relativistic case as well. And that will be the key to our theorem. So, as I said, what we're going to do is we're going to follow a geodesic observer backwards in time and figure out how the velocity changes. So I've set things up a little bit more quantitatively here so you can get a better idea of how the theorem is actually demonstrated. I won't quite go through the full demonstration. You first need a definition for this Hubble constant. And we're not using quite the standard one because we want to be able to define it for an arbitrary universe, which need not be homogeneous or isotropic. So what we're going to imagine is defining it in terms of a single geodesic observer. So we imagine a single geodesic observer moving through a universe, observing the velocities of a set of co-moving test particles. And what the geodesic observer is going to do is each time she passes two test particles, she will imagine jumping onto one and looking at the other and calculating the radial velocity difference between the two as seen by one of them, and the distance between the two as seen by one of them, and take that quotient, and that's the Hubble constant based on that measurement. And that will be our definition. It's a unidirectional definition. It depends on the direction that the observer is moving in. And it's also completely local. It doesn't depend on what's happening at large distances. It just depends on what's happening there. These co-moving test particles that I'm talking about need not actually exist for the purposes of our theorem. All that's really necessary is that we can define these velocities on the space-time. And as long as we can define them, we can use them. our derivation is going to depend on one crucial fact about these co-moving velocities. The proper acceleration at the instant the particle is being observed has to be zero. They don't have to be real geodesics, but they have to instantaneously look like geodesics. They have to have zero acceleration at the time that they are observed. Okay, one quick definition before we go to the next transparency. We're going to define the relative velocity between the observer and the co-moving test particles by just taking the dot product of the two four vectors. And if the observer is a time-like observer, this in fact is the usual special relativity gamma, 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared. Okay, we also want to consider null observers, which is why I only consider this to be true some of the time for our purposes. Okay, then one has to calculate the relationship between the Hubble constant, as I just defined it, and the rate of change of the velocity. The velocity is being described by gamma. It turns out that the Hubble constant is just equal to the rate of change of f of gamma, where f has this form for the two cases. Okay, and it's independent of the direction. The observer doesn't have to be collinear with the test particles. Completely general. And this says qualitatively what we'd expect it to say. It says that if h is positive, df d tau is positive, and therefore gamma df is increasing, and as f increases, the velocity decreases. So I call f the slowness because it's related to the velocity inversely. The larger f is, the slower the velocity. So in an expanding universe, f increases with time, and that means if we follow f backwards, it will decrease. But the key thing is that f is positive definite. It can't go below zero. When it reaches zero, that's when the observer reaches the speed of light relative to the co-moving particles. It can't go any further than that. So there's a lower limit to which you can push this. And that means if you rewrite this as the change in f is equal to the integral of h d tau, you get a bound on h d tau. And you get this absolutely rigorous bound, and following solely from kinematics. So it's a bound that limits the integral of h d tau along the backward-going geodesic in terms of the relative velocity when you start at the present time between the geodesic observer and the co-moving test particles. Now, the bound goes away if this velocity is zero. The arctangent of 1, in case you don't remember, go home and think about it, is infinite. So you get no bound if the geodesic observer is going right along the co-moving test particles. But for any other trajectory going backwards, you get a bound on the integral of hd tau. And if it's a light-like observer, then it depends on how you normalize your affine parameter. But if you pick d tau dt to be equal to 1 today, then you just get the integral of hd tau as less than 1. You'll get a similar bound. Stop. Okay, since I'm running low on time, I don't need to talk about examples. I'll just get to the punchlines. The bottom line, then, is that the theorem can be summarized by saying that for any spacetime for which you expect the average value of h along past-directed geodesics to be positive, you can conclude that those past-directed geodesics are incomplete. They can only go a finite length, and then they have to stop. One particular application that this has is the cyclic ekperiodic model, which in the early days was advertised as being eternal into the past. But h average is bigger than 0 for a single cycle of that model for null geodesics. And every cycle is identical to every other cycle. So that means that h average will be positive no matter how far back you go. And that means that if you look back along light-like geodesics, they are geodesically incomplete. And that means that you need some kind of a boundary condition at the end of those light-like lines. And therefore, the model is not free of the assumption of initial conditions. Now, there are some disclaimers I should make here about the theorem. There's no conclusion here that an eternally inflating model must have a unique beginning. And furthermore, there's no upper bound on the length of all backwards-going geodesics. In particular, if you go right along the co-moving lines, there's no bound at all. One could imagine, perhaps, that there might be some models where there are regions of contraction interspersed with regions of expansion. And then you might be able to have something that's eternal going backwards and still evade our bound. And there are also more peculiar things. Aguirre and Groton proposed a model, which I think Stephen Hawking mentioned in his talk, where you have a full de Sitter space with the arrow of time going in opposite directions in the upper and lower half. And that evades our theorem. Or you could view it as an example of our theorem. If you don't change your arrow of time, it means if you go backwards, it starts contracting instead of expanding. However, despite these disclaimers, we do, I think, have a very significant claim here that any eternally inflating model of the type that you would usually assume, namely one that was just inflating everywhere going backwards in the past, that would certainly lead to H average bigger than zero, and such a model cannot be geodesically complete. And since it's not geodesically complete, what it does mean is that even if you don't know much about the nature of this beginning, it means that if you follow geodesics backwards, you will come to a beginning, some boundary, some past boundary of the inflating region, and some new physics has to be taking over there. So some new physics, something other than inflation, has to be describe the past boundary of this inflating region. And one possibility certainly would just be a quantum origin of the type, the P type, that Stephen told us about yesterday. That's not necessarily the only thing that can happen. Let me just urge you here to pay attention to what's in the yellow box. The disclaimers here are pretty strong. By many definitions of what it means for the universe to begin, we have not shown that it can't, that it has to have a beginning. In particular, there can be backwards going geodesics that are arbitrarily long. So in that sense, the universe could be infinitely old. But even if that's the case, what's in the yellow box is still true. There are, under these assumptions, geodesically incomplete lines, and that means there has to be some new physics going on there to describe what happened at the boundary, past boundary of the inflating region. Okay, I just have a summary slide. Maybe just run through this very, very quickly. First of all, the inflationary paradigm is in great shape. That should be one of the messages you take home. And this first part lists again the recent successes of the inflationary model. On the eternal issue, I claim that both small field and large field inflationary models are generically eternal into the future. It's very hard to avoid them being eternal. I claim that this divorces the initial condition problem from observation. It makes the probability of inflation starting irrelevant as long as it's non-zero. It raises questions about the numbers of degrees of freedom that describe our universe, and it offers at least the possibility that inflation might help to choose a preferred class of vacuum states. Although eternal inflation has many attractive features, as I've emphasized, there's still also important uncertainties. We don't really know how to calculate probabilities, and that really is a very important uncertainty at the fundamental level. And finally, I addressed the question of whether or not inflation could be eternal into the past as well in the future. And I've argued that under reasonable assumptions, it cannot be. And in particular, the cyclic ekperiodic model has to be past incomplete. And by past incomplete, it means that some physics other than inflation is needed to explain how it all began. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I suspect there are a couple of questions. Let's break with precedent and start in the back of the room and move forward this time.
Alan, so I think that, first of all, I should say that I'm a great fan of eternal inflation, and I think it should stand on firmer legs. Usually we say that semi-classical gravity breaks down when you get, say, to a Planck length, because the back reaction from the quantum fluctuations that we have no control over becomes of order one as a correction to the metric. But really, that latter statement should be a condition for the breakdown of the semi-classical treatment. And it happens sometimes when you're way above the Planck length. And eternal inflation is an excellent example for that. There you have quantum fluctuations in some matter field whose back reaction has enormous effects on the global structure of the universe. So I think we're really not, even though we're far away from the Planck regime, we don't have the kind of control available to make these statements rigorous. And that's, I think, at the source of all these weird paradoxes about youth-dominated societies and so on. So I think we shouldn't play this down, because there's really there's really a need for a better defined calculation of this effect.
Yeah, well, I think I do agree there's a need for a better defined calculation, but I would also insist that in the case of new inflation, I think one is very far away from the regime where you would need quantum gravity.
Because it's killing me rather than Alan.
It is true, it's his calculation. So. No, he deserves both the credit and the blame.
No, the problem is that about chaotic inflation, where we are going closer to the Planckian density, and there fluctuations are very large, etc. So the statement is the following. At the moment when these fluctuations are generated, during De Sitter's stage, all fluctuations of metric, all fluctuations of curvature tensor and everything are very, very small.
And therefore, during this process, all quantum fluctuations can be consistently considered, and there is nothing wrong about it. What happens later, when you wait until the universe cools down and you look how these fluctuations evolve, they evolve into fluctuations with delta rho over rho of the order of 1. And that is not a failure of the theory of eternal inflation, just like the falling of the matter to the black holes is not a failure of quantum gravity. If you arrange some conditions where matter falls to the black holes, then later you'll have problems of studying it. But there is no problem of studying the process which led to creation of the black holes.
Okay.
Hello. I was wondering if this eternal inflation can provide some grounds of compromise for the anthropic and anti-anthropic camps. the initial conditions of the universe might be unique in some sense that could be predicted by string theory, where and the anthropic people could use the anthropic principle to pick out the particular inflating region of the universe in which we live. Is that a possibility? Is that a disappointing possibility?
Well, I think it's certainly a possibility that will disappoint some people and enthrall others. I think if anthropic choices are important in selecting the final vacuum, and that's important in determining the local laws of physics, which may very well turn out to be the case, I will be among the people who will be disappointed, only because I'd like the predictive power of physics to be stronger than that.
Next question.
This is a question for you, Andre, or anyone else who has a good answer. I think you touched on it. In the sort of string theory community, there's been a lot of focus on this causal patch description of physics in de Sitter space. So to what extent is there a good causal patch description of eternal inflation?
Right. My instinct would be to say that there is none, that the two really conflict, and that we're going to need to choose one or the other. And my bets are on eternal inflation, but who knows? Andre, would you like to say something?
It just seemed to me that if you try, well, artificially to put everything into the small box, then what happens? That most of the interesting stuff which you get in the universe is being compressed to the walls of this small box, and you really cannot read the image. So that's one of the problems. Another problem which you will encounter, and maybe you will see it in the talk of Nemanja Kalloper, I should not run before that, that sometimes when you think that everything is within the causal patch, you think about the universe in general like being a Friedman universe, and locally it is Friedman. But the main point of the self-reproducing universe is that globally it is a fractal. So when you have a fractal, you need to start to project the fractal onto the sphere. That's not a very good way of seeing the fractal.
I'm going to use my moderator's right to move the microphone around the room and break the thread of the conversation. We may come back to it later.
Robertson.
Yeah, I'd like to come back to Raphael's point. So I agree with Raphael that in the limit, in the region of this eternal inflation, that back reaction is not under control. And one way to see that is to calculate the effective energy momentum tensor of cosmological perturbations. And at least in the chaotic inflation model, one finds that in the entire region in which the stochastic terms are more important than the classical rolling down, that the effective energy momentum tensor of cosmological perturbations provides an even bigger effect.
Well, first of all, I say you're discussing the case that I regard as the weaker of the two, the chaotic case, although Andre would like to defend them both equally, I guess. And also, you also did the same thing that Raphael did. You talked about the regime where the quantum fluctuations are as large as the classical motion. They could be considerably smaller and still have this 1/20th probability. So the region where eternal inflation sets in is only on the borderline of the dangerous region that you're talking about. It's not well into it.
Now, which one? Where do you know that in this chaotic inflation model? Where do you know that in that
model? Well,
quantified way m to the minus 3, 1/3 of the minus 3, m is the minus 3.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by important. I mean, certainly the influence it has on phi in terms of the motion of phi during one Hubble time can be significantly smaller. than the classical motion. I'm sure of that. That's just where you start.
Okay. Lev seems to have a comment that I take it as relevant to this line of discussion.
Okay. In inflationary cosmology, when we're working with the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric, the generation of long wavelengths in homogeneities, which became classical from quantum, is the crucial point for the whole story Alan was talking about. If we take a static patch, I'm not aware of derivation of this effect. And this is a huge, huge difference. If in static patch one would be able to derive generation of long wavelength fluctuations which exceeds this path, then we will talk the same language.
Okay. Back to their side of the room.
So Alan, you talked about. So I'm thinking of, on one hand, you work your way all the way back and say there has to be a quantum or some theory of initial conditions, possibly quantum origin.
Yes.
On the other hand, if I think about all these little fluctuations that create new inflating regions, or however you want to talk about it, wouldn't an observer in one of those regions think of that fluctuation as their quantum origin? And so I'm wondering how you think about that, and you know, are they different in some way, or is it the same thing? And I'm wondering maybe if each observer has that fluctuation as this quantum origin, if that starts coinciding with what Stephen was saying about just doing a quantum, you know, one quantum origin, full stop, and not worry about what else is out there.
I think it's certainly true that each person on this tree would be most influenced by his immediate past. But I'm saying that immediate past would be determined by the steady state properties of the tree. So I would expect that if there was anything special about the way it all began once upon a time, anything that was special about that would just be washed away by the time the particular branch forms.
One more question over here.
Following up on that, any theory or any proposal you might have for initial conditions presumably will be formulated in terms of some wave function. But that wave function by itself gives you at least an unambiguous way to calculate probabilities. You might argue but whether the wave function is correct or not, but there is an unambiguous calculation that can be done by choosing a particular, or by taking a particular proposal for the past boundary conditions that you agree that we need. Now, the one proposal we've been looking at, Stephen and Jim's wave function, seems not to favor eternal inflation. It seems to favor a short period of 50 or 60 folds leading to our observed universe. So I'm wondering what you think about these calculations. Or about that way to compute probabilities, because that seems to me the central discussion.
Yes. Okay. Well, no, I think I have no objection to the general method of proposing a wave function for the universe, and the Hartle-Hawking one looks as plausible to me as any, and calculating how that evolves. But when you calculate it, I think you do have to calculate it openly. When you have a scalar field at the top of the hill, which you need to get enough inflation to describe your universe, you need to put in the quantum fluctuations of that scalar field, which in a path integral language means you have to put in the paths which eternally inflate for a long time and sum over them. And it's my belief that if you do put them in and sum over them, that they will dominate. If you leave them out, you don't see them.
Okay, but have you disagreed with the semi-classical approximation?
Well, I claim the semi-classical approximation leads to eternal inflation. The probability for the scalar field to stay at the top of the hill falls off exponentially in the semi-classical approximation. And that exponential rate is always slower than the exponential expansion rate in any successful model of inflation.
So we can let Thomas and Alan speak a little bit later in detail.
Yeah, we'll talk more later.
Just one more question before lunch.
When Andre derived his wave function for us in a seminar several weeks ago, it was very striking that at the end of the day, it looked like the answer he got was the same thing that you would get from the tunneling wave, from a Euclidean tunneling description, even though you used a totally Lorentzian stochastic process. So I guess I'm asking, is it clear that is it possible everybody's saying the same thing in a different language? Because the answers seem to be rather similar.
I think I would say, for all I know, it is possible. But since neither of us really know how to calculate it, at this point we don't know. I think from my point of view, the right criterion to determine the right answer is the eternal inflation criterion. But it may very well lead to the Hartle-Hawking wave function, for all I know. I would not rule out that possibility.
The answer is not hard. You predict that we live infinitely far away from the origin of the universe. You predict that.
Well, but that's not a very directly measurable quantity.
Maybe you should answer Płaczynski, because he asked. In the way we have derived an expression which is very similar to Hartle-Hawking wave function and Tomlinson wave function simultaneously, was based on stochastic approach to inflation, and there you had under certain conditions, which not always satisfied, you really see the square of the wave function of Hartle-Hawking multiplied by the square of the wave function of tunneling, which we with Alex Vilenkin like. But the interpretation of the Hartle-Hawking part of the wave function is completely opposite to their own interpretation of it. In the way how we derived it, it is the probability of a final state of the universe rather than initial.
Okay. Well, I think it's time to cut off this interesting discussion and move on to lunch. So let's thank Alan again.